be. It's the people that say,
yes, indeed. It is time for Message in the Bottle. Eric Mann of Bangor Wine and Cheese Company, 86 Hammond Street, downtown Bangor, joining us. And yes, you've got your backstory.
Live from Miami.
not true. You're not.
I'm not.
But the Dead was live. And guess who was at this very show we're hearing? Yes, yeah,
okay,
indeed.
Okay, yes, like, it was eeny, me. Eeny, miny, moe. Probably care.
July 1990, Buffalo's Rich Stadium. Nice. The Grateful Dead. I was very happy when he sent me your music request.
Awesome.
Today.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. And then I figured out that like it's the same music as Cyndi Lauper. It's Ico Ico,
yeah.
Which is another one I'm sure you're very familiar with. And the Dead covered all the time too, because they're like, this is the same song. Yeah, let's go with it.
Yeah, we can do it. We know how to play it.
That's right. God, I love that song. And it came along at the right time in my life when I found a woman who was smarter and I was like, the Dead knew.
Oh, yes, yes.
What I didn't know is that Robert Palmer covered that song.
Robert Palmer?
Not as well.
And the Carpenters.
Yeah. That's so strange. Gosh. But anyway, yeah, I'm a closet Deadhead. One of my great customers back in my Princeton days, because we would listen to it all the time in the shop, said, the Dead is Muzak for intelligent people. And it really was. It was like, you know, because you go into places and they're just piping in music. You're like, oh, this is awful. But people would come in, all swaths, you know, any profession you could name, you know, suits to Hawaiian shirts. And every one of them would be like, yeah. It was cool. It was fun. So lots to get to today. Maybe we'll get through it. Maybe we won't. There's a couple things that I wasn't planning on necessarily talking about that I'm going to talk about because I have the power. And so Carrie shuts me off. That's fair. He has the power. Let's be honest. So, obviously, over the weekend, we had quite a stunning occurrence in the world. And it's gotten me thinking a lot, not necessarily that I'm a big basketball fan. And if anyone read my newsletter, one of the weirder things that kind of has come full circle recently is that I was singing in Aspen when Kobe Bryant was having certain legal troubles about 40 miles north in Eagle. And it was actually crazy because like the world descended on this part of the, you know, it's pretty remote. So that always tainted my view of that. But what really I kind of wanted to talk about, and we'll get this into wine in a moment, was, you know, anybody who knows me knows I'm a very proud father of two children, and the aspect of what he was doing in terms of trying to teach and guide his daughter to the point where, listening to Tracy McGrady talk about his relationship with them, he said she looked like him on the court. That's really cool. And it kind of got me thinking, like, you know, it's imperative of all parents to try and pass on like what we have. Right. But it's not necessarily fair to think kids are going to go into your family business. And frankly, I grew up with a man, my father telling me, don't ever work with your family. Cause he worked with his father and his brother and things like that. And, you know, so for better or worse, you know, but, it got me thinking that in the past couple of years I've been doing this show and this spot, we talk a lot about the facts of wine, right? We talk a lot about the thing, but I don't maybe talk enough about how societally different certain winemaking cultures are to our own, because they are very, very different. And I guess I just sort of wanted to point that I will try to this year and in the future make that more of a point. And in this particular topic, I just kind of wanted to you know, remind everybody that in a lot of parts of the world, there's essentially equality in the winemaking world where none exists elsewhere. Certainly, in France, our wine of the week, as I mentioned again in my newsletter, is made by a woman who's now middle-aged, but she started by her dad's side when she was just a kid. And he still kind of oversees, and he's a very proud father. That's the Faro family. But this is, and it's not just father daughter, but it's also equality amongst, husband and wives. Very often the estates will be, both of their names. There will be estates run by women. There will be estates run by men. They'll change hands, and it's never considered to be anything other than, well, they learned at the, you know, the same hands as anybody else would have, and I'm sure that they're quite good at this. And this isn't just France, of course. There are certain societies that have a little more machismo associated with them, but even in those, I'm not trying, obviously, to offend anybody, but, you know, even places like Italy, you know, the Sanguinetti estate, which is in Tuscany, is run by a very, very, very dynamic woman, and the wines she makes are brilliant, and she's like idolized by everybody. The way Kobe was idolized by everybody. She's like amazing. People come to her and say, "Please teach me," and she's very considerate of doing that. And it goes, you know, from her to Mas Martinet in Priorat with Sarah Perez. In Spain, all the way to Oregon, Brianna Day is one of my favorite winemakers there. There's equality in the winemaking world, and a certain acceptance of passing on one's traditions and knowledge, regardless of sex. And it's brilliant, and I need to sort of bring that out a little bit more, because I just think it's important, right? And again, like, you know, going back to myself, I try to let my kids, you know, even now, taste, smell, understand what we do. They work occasionally at the shop, and they enjoy the heck out of it. And does that mean they're going to be wine merchants? I don't know. Probably not. But the field is open to them, and it was pretty cool to hear about all the tributes of that, because that's the most important thing. I mean, sports is sports, and sports is great because we aspire to standards in sports that we don't hold other people to the same standards that we really should. And I feel like that's why I've sort of escaped into ESPN land instead of NPR land lately. But just food for thought. We'll move on from that to another really random topic that I didn't necessarily plan on talking about today, but something that I'm intrigued in with, and we'll follow it as it goes. The phylloxera louse, and of course, longtime listeners to this know what the phylloxera louse is. It is a very, very tiny bug that lives under the ground, and it feeds on rootstocks. It is basically North American in origin, specifically the East Coast. And of course, famously, and we'll talk more about this as the months go on, when botanical clippings of the New World were sent back to Europe, the bug went with them and destroyed 99% of Europe's vineyards. This is back in the 1860s, 70s. So a lot of places that are desert areas, and we were recently talking about Chile, for instance, right, in Argentina, are free from phylloxera. It's too dry. They can't survive there. And another desert area that we talked about a couple months back, I suppose, at this point, is Washington State. Well, phylloxera just got discovered in Walla Walla.
Yeah.
And so what I want to sort of talk about, at least here initially, is we have a modern society who knows exactly what the threat is. They've seen what this bug can do. And it's really fascinating looking at the response. Apparently, they've known for about 6 months. And essentially what they did is, you know, they mapped areas digitally now where growth of vines was not as they expected. And they had their suspicions, I guess, for a little while, and it was confirmed. And the reaction is one of both denial, which is such a typical, you know, it's just like, I mean, you know, shout out to all my men out there. Like, when the doctor tells you, hey, you've got something wrong with you and you're going to have to change your lifestyle. Yeah.
Yeah. I need a second opinion.
Yeah.
And a third.
But that's precisely what's going on. And why? Well, because the identity they feel of their terroir and their wines is, and for those of you who don't really know where Walla Walla is, it is an appellation that actually kind of straddles into Oregon. It's in, and it's surrounded by all sorts of vegetation, which apparently they've known for years has shown evidence of this louse.
Now, was that near? Was it the Willamette Valley that we've talked about?
It's farther east. But obviously the fears are it spreads really quickly. And so essentially what they're being told, folks, is see those vineyards out there? You have to go rip them all up and replant all of your vines on louse-resistant rootstock. That's quite a thing to tell anybody. And so that's going to be very intriguing for us to watch as we go forward, because it's still a fairly minor appellation in the scope of the world. But in terms of Washington State, it was growing. It's a combination of science, and there's a lot of scientific research done out in that part of the world on viticulture and agriculture in general, and the stubbornness of winemakers. As I said, it's going to be intriguing. I, of course, will keep you up to date if anything comes of it, but it should be fairly fascinating. I have about five more minutes, maybe a little less. Getting back to what I was going to talk about today, we talk at this time basically about sort of the basics as we start to learn a little bit more about what is wine, and then we'll delve into the world of wine. But I like to take this time and talk about some of my favorite books in order to help you all go out and learn and read. It sounds like we've got some more snow on the way. And then we'll talk a little bit about getting in a car and driving around and what you can go see in Maine. And if we don't get to that today, I'll get to it another time. So books I like and books you should like and go get learning. The first book that I ever read in this industry was Wine for Dummies. it just is. Ed McCarthy and Mary Ewing Mulligan. It is a ponderous tome, to be honest. It's quite large, and you do not need to read all of it. It's set up very, very intelligently for newbies and for professionals alike. So I can't recommend it enough. It did me well. It's not an exciting recommendation, but there it is. The other wine book that I find absolutely indispensable, and I pick it up, I can't tell you how many times a week, is The World Atlas of Wine by two masters of wine, Hugh Johnson, pardon me, and Jancis Robinson. And they've been doing this, I believe it's on its seventh edition now. They've been doing it for a long, long time. I like maps. They really sort of help me figure out what's going on, because that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about terroir, is where things are betterer than other places. And why? And you get to see the elevation maps, and you get to see the, it's very, very well done. And every edition includes, you know, new parts on the ever expanding world of wine. And it's really cool. Is it cheap? No, but you don't need to buy another one for a long, long, long time. Even if another edition comes out, it will serve you very well. And then two books that I like to read for inspirational purposes, right? One is Adventures on the Wine Route by a guy named Kermit Lynch. Kermit Lynch, I'm sure you've heard me talk about his history before. He was one of the first importers and the first to sort of document what he was doing, bringing in temperature-controlled small production wine from France, and really establishing that we can bring in, like, really, really cool stuff. It doesn't just have to be the mass-produced, mass-market stuff that everybody else knew. And then the other one is Wine and War by Don and Pitty Cladstrip, Wine and War, that is, which is a story about the Nazi occupation of France, or at least two-thirds of it, during World War II, and what those folks did during that time to cohabitate and make it all work, because they all knew that when the war was over, they were going to have to go back to just being normal business partners. And there is a lot to think about, because we are all in sort of a state of disarray these days, and we need to remember that when it comes to the end of all things, we still do need to be neighborly and helpful. And so a lot to think about there. Our tasting in February, by the way, we are going to move back a week to the 27th because of school vacation. So I'll keep mentioning that, but just something to keep in mind. And so next week we'll talk a little bit more about places you can go in Maine and things you'll see, hybrid varietals, things like that. And we're going to move into wine agriculture in February, and it'll be a lot of fun. So I look forward to seeing you next week, talking to you. I got to stop doing that.
No, you, it, They're looking at the radio. You're looking at the microphone. We're seeing each other.
Look at the radio right now. I'm flashing you my winning smile.
Look at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Save that for the father-daughter dance this weekend.
Oh, that's going to be a frozen smile of... more a Richter of madness. Rictus of madness.
Well, have fun at that.
Cheers. Thank you.
Eric Mann, Bangor Wine and Cheese Company. Message in the Bottle every Tuesday on Downtown. Of course, you can check out all of Eric's segments by going to our website, downtownwithrichkimble.com, and click on the Message in the Bottle tab.